Domestic abuse or wife beating was a prominent occurrence in Victorian England, with many victims having to put up with abuse on a daily basis. It was socially acceptable for that period and was seen by many as nothing more than a lower class issue. It's been written in many publications that during the Victorian era, religion played a big part in culture, and that for a woman to be virtuous and to serve God, they must follow the lead of their husband. This, of course, seemingly gave the nod for husbands to control and do whatever they deemed appropriate to their wives, which in many instances meant physical violence. With that said, let's get into today's story, and we are travelling way back to the early morning of Saturday the 19th of August 1899, and to the small town of Whitworth, which resides between Bacup and Rochdale in the parish of Rossendale, England. Ellen Dowdall, a 35-year-old weaver and mother to five children, had spent a couple of hours working at the Whitworth Co-op Mill, covering for another worker who was off sick. She had agreed to work 3 days a week, taking on four looms in doing so, and with the promise of more work to follow. By mid-morning, she was working alongside another mill employee when she spoke about being worried about going home, saying, "I fear there's bound to be trouble for me," to which the other employee said, "Oh, don't think that, Mrs. Dowdall. It'll be dinner time soon, and then your work will be done." Finishing work at around noon, Ellen made her way to Grove Terrace, where she'd been living for the past week with a Mr. and Mrs. O'Brien, after having left her marital home at 20 Copeland Street the week before, following a huge row with her husband, Michael. She would stay there for much of the afternoon until around 3 o'clock p.m, when it was reported that after her husband called at the house, and after a short discussion between the pair, she was persuaded by Michael to return back home with him. This would be the last time the O'Briens would ever see their friend Ellen alive ever again. Michael and Ellen Dowdall had lived at number 20 Copeland Street for the past 2 years, along with their five children: Thomas, aged 14, John, aged 10, William, aged 5, Edward, aged 18 months, and their daughter Bridget, who was aged 8. And prior to living in Whitworth, they had lived for 10 years in Ashworth Street, Fulledge, in Burnley. But this isn't where their story began. Michael, who was a native of Carrick-on-Shore, Ireland, had enlisted into the army in 1878 with the 18th Royal Irish Regiment, but within 14 months he had requested a transfer into the 24th Foot Regiment of Foot, which was then in Africa. However, upon arriving in Cape Town, he found that the 24th had a full complement of men, and he was consequently moved onto the 21st Regiment of Foot. Dowdall would soon find himself embroiled in the Zulu War, and he fought in the Battle of Ulundi on the 4th of July 1879. He would go on to suffer from an injury to his thigh and was subsequently discharged from the army on the 20th of April 1880 and sent to Netley Hospital in England before returning back home to Ireland, where he would stay until around 1884. He would then relocate to Whitworth in the northwest of England. Ellen Norris had lived in Waterford, Ireland, prior to her moving to England, where she found a board living in Waterside, Bacup. Sometime around 1883, she moved to Whitworth to work as a weaver at Kay's Mill, and it was here she would make acquaintances with Mrs. Margaret O'Brien a year later, and they would go on to become closest of friends. Now, it's not clear as to when, but Michael and Ellen's paths would eventually cross, and after a short courtship, they would eventually go on to get married, sometime around 1885 at the Roman Catholic Chapel in Whitworth. The first 3 years of their marriage were spent in Whitworth before they would eventually move to Burnley. And it was in Burnley that Michael would develop a bad temper and selfish attitude towards Ellen. And 8 years after having moved, and having become worn down by Michael's behaviour, Ellen would pack some of her belongings and return back to Whitworth, taking with her her children, where she would stay with lifelong friend Mrs. O'Brien. 18 months would pass before Michael himself returned back to Whitworth. Here he would reconcile with Ellen, and together with their children, they would become lodgers within the O'Brien's house, before finally moving to number 20 Copeland Street some months later. However, their short time living in Copeland Street would see them argue on a constant basis, with Ellen moving out on many occasions due to Michael's drinking and abusive nature towards her. The shouting and screaming coming from their house would become a normal occurrence and something the neighbours would have to, unfortunately, get used to. So this now kind of brings us up to date, well, sort of, and a week before Ellen's murder. On Saturday the 12th of August, Ellen had walked to the New Inn pub where Michael was drinking. Now, she'd gone there to ask for some money, but instead of giving her any, Michael threatened her, saying he would do her harm once he returned home. Because of his threatening behaviour and having a history of violence towards her, Ellen was too afraid to return that night, and despite it being quite late in the evening, around 10 p.m, she made her way to the O'Briens, where she would stay for the following week. Now, the next morning, on Sunday the 13th, Michael sent his youngest son, Edward, who was only 18 months old at the time, to the O'Briens to be cared for. The week quickly passed by, and on Saturday the 19th of August, Michael walked the quarter of Sawmile to Grove Street where Ellen was staying with the O'Briens. It was just after 4 p.m. in the afternoon, and after spending some time with Ellen, he somehow managed to coax her away with promises of never hurting her again. The O'Briens testified in the subsequent hearings that they had overheard Michael saying to Ellen, "Are you not coming back to look after your poor children?" To which Ellen replied, "If I go home, you will beat me." Michael had sat himself down, and in a forgiving tone he said, "If you come home, I'll do naught to you." Now, for whatever reasons, we will never know, Ellen was convinced by Michael to return home. So she took hold of Edward in her arms, and the three of them made their short walk across town and back to number 20 Copeland Street. On the way, a lady by the name of Mrs. Flynn said she spoke to Ellen in passing, asking her how she was. Ellen simply replied, "Only middling." Mrs. Flynn, however, wasn't convinced by Ellen's demeanour and had a feeling that Ellen herself was fearful as to what harm Michael could or perhaps would do to her on their return home. According to their son Thomas, Ellen and Michael arrived back at the house at around 4:15 p.m. and all seemed fine. But just after 4:30 p.m, Thomas said he went out to play with his brothers and sisters, and 15 minutes later, at around 4:45 p.m, the arguing would soon begin. From witness accounts, neighbours corroborated what Thomas had said by saying they heard screams of murder coming from the Dowdless house at around this time. Caroline Gibbons of 23 Street was stood against the kitchen door leading to the outside when she heard a commotion coming from the Dowdles, and soon after Bridget Dowdle came running down shouting, "There's my mother," crying out, "Will you come in?" Now, Caroline didn't go into the house, but instead went over and stood just outside and peered through the open door. Inside, she saw Michael Dowdle kneeling over Ellen, who was lying on the floor. With his back facing her, Caroline said Michael had his hands around Ellen's neck, and while she couldn't make out what he was using, it was obvious he was cutting at her neck. Fearing for the worst, she ran to a neighbouring house to raise the alarm. Now, a boy by the name of Robert Taylor, who was just aged 12 years old at the time, had also heard the screaming coming from the Dowdle's house. Making his way from nearby East Street, he saw Caroline standing in the doorway of the Dowdles, and after witnessing Michael attacking Mrs. Dowdle, he ran back to his home and told his mother what he had seen before making his way to the police station to get help. Meanwhile, Michael was still kneeling over his defenceless wife, hacking away at her throat while stabbing her multiple times in the process. Along with Caroline, a small number of people had heard the ensuing commotion, and they had started to congregate just outside of the Dowdles' house. And yet nobody had tried to intervene and save Ellen's life. They were all fearing for their own safety. 2 to 3 minutes passed, and satisfied with his work, Michael stood up and dropped the weapon he had used to butcher his wife onto a slop stone. Caroline shouted to him, "You bad man, you are killing your wife." Another boy by the name of Robert Culver, aged 17, of Church Street, had also seen the attack and shouted to Michael, "Come out, you brute," to which Michael replied, "I'm not a brute." Another witness cried out, "Fetch the police," and again Michael replied, "I'll go to the police." Not saying a word, Michael turned and walked past Caroline and out onto the street. Those that had witnessed the attack on Ellen simply stood aside, allowing Michael to pass them. Out on the street was his daughter Bridget, who was holding her brother Edward in her arms. Upon seeing her, he calmly walked over to her, knelt down and gave her a kiss on the cheek. She was frightened and hysterical, shrieking at the sight of her blood-covered father. A few seconds passed before he stood up and, followed by a crowd of women and children, he casually made his way down the road and towards the police station. Somebody shouted to him, "You old murderer, you old villain," to which he replied, "I'm going now." Having already been alerted by witnesses, Sergeant Butler and Inspector Leedale had already left the police station with two accompanying police officers, and within minutes they had caught up with Michael, who was then swiftly apprehended in the street. Taking note of him, Michael was reported to have said, "Don't hold me so tight, Sergeant. I'm going down to the police station." Michael was then handed over to the constables and taken to the police station whilst Butler and Leedale made their way to the Dowdle's house. Upon entering the Dowdle's house, Butler saw Ellen Dowdle lying on the floor and at full length, her feet towards the centre of the room with her head against a cupboard which was situated close to a fireplace. She was lying partly on her right side with her back against the fireplace fender. A large pool of blood was covering the floor, along with areas of walls and scantily placed furniture that was close by to her body. On Monday the 21st of August 1899, Michael Dowdle was brought up before the Rochdale Magistrates Court. The hearing was brief, lasting around 30 minutes. As soon as the doors to the courtroom opened, and due to the large interest in the case, people rushed in to take their seats, mainly men, with only a small handful of women being present. It was around 10:30 a.m. when Dowdle was brought into the dock, and despite the charges being put before him, he sat in a calm and quiet manner. 10 minutes later, Magistrate Mr. T. Smithson and Mr. A. Brealey made their appearances. Dowdall was told to stand up, which he promptly did. He was then formally charged with the willful murder of his wife Ellen by cutting and stabbing her about the face, neck and head with a carving or a bread knife. Superintendent McQueen started the proceedings by going through the facts of the case, followed by Sergeant Butler, who would also talk step by step into the events leading up to and after the murder of Ellen Dowdall. After the opening statements made by McQueen and Butler, the clerk, Mr. G. L. Collins, asked Dowdall if he had any questions, to which he replied, "No, sir." With that, the clerk remanded Dowdall until Friday, the 25th of August. 4 days later, and again at around 10:30 a.m, the inquest into the murder of Ellen Dowdall would take place within the club room of the New Inn, Whitworth, and would be conducted by the coroner, Mr. F. N. Molesworth Hepworth. With a cool and solid demeanour, Michael Dowdall took a seat at the coroner's table. Flanked either side of him were two representatives of the press, as well as two police officers who stood directly behind him. He sat in his chair, listening closely to all of the evidence from the witnesses, as one by one they gave their own version of events. Now and again he would turn his attention towards the two press officers who were making sketchings within inches of him. Meanwhile, outside of the New Inn, the feelings towards Dowdall were manifesting. He had been taken from the Rochdale police station to the inquest by a cab and was greeted by loud booing and yelling from the crowds that had lined the route he had taken. Outside the New Inn, hundreds of people had gathered, mostly women, all awaiting his arrival. One or two violent clashes erupted as soon as his cab pulled up, but Dowdall was escorted into the building via the back entrance. The loud cries of "murderer" filled the now toxic air, along with more booing and catcalls. Margaret O'Brien would be the first to give evidence, followed by Caroline Gibbons. Both would go into detail not only what happened on the day Ellen Dowdall was murdered, but would also give evidence as to what life was like for Ellen leading up to her murder. Both would say she was a kind, hard-working and forgiving lady who lived for her children. Whilst the family may not have had the best of starts in life, Ellen would always make sure her children were well-dressed, well-mannered and looked after. And yet, beneath her exterior, inside she was a lady broken from the constant abuse at the hands of her husband and the fearing of her own life. Other witnesses came forward, including neighbours on Church Street, who would back up what O'Brien and Gibbons had already said. They would also tell of the regular shouting and quarrelling that could be heard coming from the Dowdall's house late in the evenings, and the times when Ellen had walked out, partly dressed and seemingly in fear of her life. Sergeant Butler and Inspector Leedale would be brought into question, and they would again go into detail as to what they encountered when they made their way into Dowdall's home. Upon finding Ellen Dowdall, they stated that she was still alive but barely able to breathe. She gasped a few times, but would die around a minute or so after being found lying on the floor. Meanwhile, a large carving knife was found to be left lying on a slop stone nearby, covered in blood and hair. This was produced at the inquest as evidence. Dr. Forbes, a surgeon from Whitworth, was next to be called upon. He had made a post-mortem on Ellen Dowdall and gave a careful description of the wounds of the body. On the right-hand side of her neck, there was a large gaping wound, around 3.5 inches long. It was skin deep to begin with, but went deeper towards the opposite end, somewhere in the region of 1.25 inch deep. The jugular vein had been opened, and the softer parts over it had been opened. On the back of the neck were two incised wounds, passing vertically into the muscles. She also had two deep wounds that would be associated to stab wounds. She had also suffered from cuts to her forehead and a deep cut under her right eye that exposed the bone. On the palm side of her right hand fingers there were 7 wounds. Her left fingers contained a further 5 more wounds. This indicated that she had fought for her life to the bitter end. The jury would enter into a private consultation which would last just 7 minutes, and upon their return they gave a verdict of willful murder. Outside the club room, the crowd had swelled to treble the size it was, and as Dowdall was escorted to his cab for his removal to catch the 6 o'clock train back to Rochdale, a perfect storm of booing flooded the air with many shouting "brute," "coward," and "murderer." All along the route taken by the cab, an angry mob followed, rushing it on more than one occasion. Sergeant Butler and Inspector Leedale, along with 5 other police officers, struggled to maintain order, and inside the cab, Dowdall sat, and for the first time since his arrest, he looked pale and frightened as he cast glances at the baying mob outside. The trial of Michael Dowdall took place at the Manchester Assizes on Thursday, the 16th of November 1899. Prosecutors Mr. Ford and Mr. Pope took to the stand to put before the jury the facts of the case, with Mr. Ford bringing many witnesses forward that included Margaret O'Brien and Caroline Gibbons. Mr. Ambrose Jones, defending Michael, cross-examined Gibbons, who would go on to state that whilst Michael was murdering his wife, he was completely oblivious to the shouting and screaming coming from those watching outside, and once he had finished his evil deed, he stood up and dropped the carving knife onto the slop stone. Gibbons shouted for someone to go and fetch policemen, to which Dowdall replied, "Never you bother, I'll fetch him myself." Dr. Forbes was brought to the stand to not only give details as to the injuries Ellen Dowdall suffered, but would also be cross-examined by Mr. Jones about Michael and how he'd suffered in the months leading up to the murder of Ellen Dowdall. He would go on to mention that Michael had suffered a serious accident in April whilst working in the quarries local to Whitworth, and how, that while he may not have shown any ill effects while being examined at the time, the effects can manifest themselves at some point later in the future. He would also go on to prove that whilst he was serving in Africa, Michael suffered from sunstroke, which may have led to the violent tendencies he began to show several years after being discharged from the army. Once all of the witnesses had been questioned, and upon his summing up, Mr. Jones addressed the jury and said it would be a waste of time to insult their common sense to say that Ellen Dowdall didn't meet with her death at the hands of Michael Dowdall. He would also go on to say that whilst Michael was guilty, it would not be right for him to say he was insane at the time of the act of the murder. Strangely though, he would ask the jury to take into account that he had no intention of taking away the life of his wife or inflict grievous bodily harm on her, and that for some reason, in such a dreadful and ungovernable passion, that he did not appreciate the gravity of what he was doing. He would therefore ask them to say that Michael was guilty of the crime of manslaughter. Mr. Jones would also ask the jury to take into consideration the head injury Michael had sustained whilst working in the quarries, as well as the effects sunstroke may have had on him, saying that the prisoner did not act in cold blood, but owing to some irresistible impulse for which he was more than to be pitied than punished. However, his lordship in summing up said it was quite clear that the unhappy woman was butchered to death, and there was no reason to doubt that she met her death at the hands of the prisoner. The jury returned a verdict of guilty and recommended the prisoner to mercy. His lordship thought differently, and after donning the custodial black cap, the sentence of death was passed down in the usual manner. Michael would spend the last 3 weeks of his life within the walls of Strangeways Jail, where he would eventually be taken to the gallows and executed on Wednesday, the 6th of December, 1899. A black flag was hoisted at 8 a.m. that morning to bring to an end a tragic story of how domestic abuse took the life of an innocent woman whilst leaving five children parentless and leaving a deep scar running throughout a small community. Four of the Dowdall children would be adopted by Mr. J. Karen of 9 Allen Street, Bakeup, where he would bring them up as his own. He at first took in two of them and then proposed to look after Bridget as well as the youngest child, Edward. It is unknown what happened to the fifth child. Ellen Dowdall was interred within Fassett Cemetery, which is now called Whitworth Cemetery, at around 4 p.m. on Thursday, the 24th of August, 1899, less than a week after her murder. A great deal of public sympathy followed, with a reported 10,000 people lining the streets from where her body was taken from her home and towards the cemetery, which is roughly 1 mile away. Her body was encased inside a handsome oak coffin, which was conveyed on an open Metropolitan cab. As it made its way towards the cemetery, her five children would follow close behind, all weeping bitterly. As for Michael Dowdall, he would be buried within the walls of Strangeways Jail and would lie in the shadows until 1991, when, along with other executed criminals, his body would be dug up and taken to Blackley Cemetery, where his remains would be cremated. His ashes are now buried within one of two unmarked graves, simply numbered C2710 and C2711. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this story, and if you want more, please show some support and comment down below. You can follow me on Twitter and on Instagram, which the links are also down below. But in the meantime, take care, and I'll be back soon with another tale from the past.